Welcome to Creature Feature, a production of iHeartRadio. I'm your host of Mini Parasites, Katie Golden. I studied psychology and evolutionary biology, and today on the show, Broodex. There's often generational battles. Boomers complaining about millennials, Gen X complaining about Zoomers, Zoomers duking it out with boomers in the Thunderdome. But perhaps as we have our petty generational fights, we should stop to consider what's happening under our feet. Something is stirring. In fact, millions of somethings are stirring. Brood X is about to emerge, and we should put aside our petty squabbles about whether millennials eat too many avocados or Zoomers do too many TikToks about avocados, and prepare ourselves for Brood X that has been waiting 17 years to emerge from the ground. What is Brood X? Should we panic? Must we accept Brood X as our new leaders? And how might we ingratiate ourselves to them? Discover this and more as we answer the age-old question. How is it fair that swarms of baby turtles are considered cute, but swarms of bugs are considered, quote, horrifying? Joining me today to discuss Brood X and other mass spawning events is author of the book Where Am I Now?, actress and unofficial president of all millennials, Mara Wilson. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm very excited to talk about this. Brood X, it sounds a lot scarier than it actually is, I think.
Or is it? No, you're right.
That's true.
It sounds scary. It sounds like this is our comeuppance as a species, and we're about to face the music, the very loud music. But it is actually a very, very interesting thing in evolutionary biology. So this Brood X is a mass cicada bloom. First, I want to ask you, Mara, how's your feelings towards cicadas?
You know, I don't think they have them where I grew up. Or at least not in the ways that they do on the East Coast, because so 17 years, so they were, because I do remember hearing about them when I was a teenager.
Yes.
So probably when I was, that was 2004. So I would have been 16 or 17. And I do remember spending my summer on the East Coast. And I think that was the first time I'd ever heard cicadas.
Yeah. Yeah. I think we do get, so I grew up in San Diego and I think we get some cicadas there.
Yeah.
But definitely we don't get the mass brooding events. That happens on the East Coast.
I think like maybe I'd heard them before, but I didn't know what they were. Whereas when I lived on the East Coast, like I'd heard cicadas and I knew what they sounded like. And I think, yeah, I was like visiting family on the East Coast and 2004. And I was like, what's this weird noise in the trees that seems to be everywhere? And what are these like dead bodies littered on the ground? So I'm kind of indifferent to them. I don't think that they're like, I like the sounds of crickets chirping. I don't mind the sounds of cicadas so much. It is a bit overwhelming and it is a bit gross when like their corpses littered the streets. But again, I haven't had to deal with that as much. So it's not, you know, it's not as much of an annoyance as coyotes are to me, or like snails or things like that, where I'm like, gross, you know?
Yeah. Well, so, good thing you missed the giant snail episode that we did.
Yeah. Snails gross me out so much. I'm sorry, Katie, but I'm going to have to skip that episode because I think they're the grossest things ever.
My friend Bridget also, she's been on the show, also disgusted by snails.
Yeah.
So I won't tell you the story about when I was a toddler, I used to just eat garden snails.
Whoa. I mean, that's you know, that's French.
It is, right?
Yeah, that's gourmet.
Very Basque, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Now I can't eat escargot. Maybe it's because I, like, as a kid, it's just like, you know what? I've eaten enough snails, so I think I'm good.
Yeah, I've heard it's also not very good unless it's prepared a certain way. So
yes.
It's like one of those things that turns out kind of rubbery and yeah.
Yeah, I don't know how I managed. The reason I know I ate snails because I barely remember anything from that age is that my mom said that I'd go out in the yard and then come back and I had like snail shell all over my face.
Oh my God, I'm sorry. I can't.
Oh, I'm sorry, Mara.
I can't. Yeah, I'm gagging.
I haven't done that in quite a while.
Though, I know. But just the idea is.
Well, that's your gross out of the episode. Thanks for being a champ.
I figured there would be one.
So, yeah, so cicadas, maybe not that gross, but maybe a little intimidating. So this spring in the U.S., we are welcoming millions of cicadas into the world in a mass hatching event. So, yay!
Yeah.
I guess, like, before we talk about the mass spawning, let's talk about, like, what even is a cicada?
Right.
They are a very loud bug. They are a true bug. They're like, we call a lot of insects bugs, but there are just a few species that are known as like true bugs.
Yeah.
And others that I guess are wannabe bugs. I don't know. But
cicadas, is it like how there's no such thing as a fish? Like I always thought like bug was kind of like a fake name that was just sort of grouping a bunch of different creatures together.
There's actually, there is actually true bugs.
Yes.
So, yeah, I mean, taxonomy gets very, I don't know, there's a lot of gray areas. There's a lot of like, you know, like with, you mentioned with fish, there are like rafe and fish and then, but a lot of things that aren't fish are called fish, like jellyfish are not fish, they're cnidarians. We're actually going to talk about some more cnidarians at the end of the episode, which will be very strange. But yeah, so cicadas, true bugs, and they're actually related to leaf hoppers, those cute little leaf-shaped bugs that are really good jumpers.
Oh, yeah.
And they come in really interesting shapes. So I think we did an episode on leaf hoppers before, but yeah, they are very interesting bugs, very beautiful.
They are. That's like one of the things that like blows. It's like if you ever want to blow like a four-year-old's mind, you know, show them a picture of a leaf hopper. Because I remember being in like preschool and kindergarten and going to, I don't know if it was a nature preserve or what, but seeing leaf hoppers and stick bugs and just losing my shit. Like, what? Yeah. How does this exist? How does this, how is this a thing? Yeah.
It looks, they look like made up bugs that someone like paper mache'd together.
Yeah.
And was like, yeah, I'm just going to make a bug that's a leaf.
But I never would have thought they were related to cicadas.
Yeah, yeah. Like leaf hoppers have that sort of triangular shape. So they're different. So there's leaf bugs that have the sort of flat leaf. And then there's leaf hoppers where they still look like leaves, but they're like kind of folded up leaves where they have that triangular shape. And they're really good jumpers. If you've ever like, you may see something that looks like a little leaf, but then it has like little legs and then you try to pick it up and then it just almost disappears by how quickly it can jump. That's a leaf hopper. And cicadas are sort of like bigger versions of this, except they don't typically camouflage as leaves. They have wings and a thick triangular body. There are many species of cicadas. And they come in a variety of colors, from black to brown to green. There's even orange and blue hues. And they are fairly decently sized. So the smaller species are about 0.75 inches or about 2 centimeters. And the largest species can be over 2 1/4 inches long or 5.7 centimeters. So, you know, big.
Meaty. Yeah. I've seen them before and they are pretty big. The ones that I've seen were pretty big. Yeah.
Yeah. Like you don't want to get hit in the face with them, like when you're on your bike, just for example, no reason.
I mean, I haven't had that happen, but I have had, what are the Jerusalem beetles or not Jerusalem? They're like the big. Yeah. Or what
Jerusalem
are the
Jerusalem crickets?
What are, it's not Jerusalem crickets. What am I thinking of? They're like the big flying, there's these big flying things that are like big and blue. They look like giant bees.
Those are.
I don't know what they're called. We have them in Southern California.
I think they're Are you thinking about June bugs?
June bugs? Or? No, they're not June bugs because they're like they like fold in on themselves. They like roll up and they fly and they're like brightly colored and they look like they're like some kind of flying beetle.
Oh, and interesting.
But I've gotten one in my hair before.
Oh yeah,
I was like by my friend's pool and one got caught in my hair. I've also found multiple spiders in my hair before,
which I think
means, or only one at a time, but like I found a spider in my hair once and then like, I can't even remember it happening, but just last year I found a spider in my hair and I was like, oh no, not again. And I was like, wow, that's a weird thing to think. I'm just proving my goth side. Like, oh, spider, I got a spider in my hair again.
Oh no. Yeah. Oh gosh. Yeah. I have bad like luck with things getting in my hair too. I was at, well, I won't name the restaurant, so I won't get sued, but I was at a burger restaurant and I felt something land on my head and I was like, well, that's strange. And I just sort of mindlessly reach up and pick it up and it's a giant cockroach.
Oh, God.
Just, yeah. And I was like, waiter, there's a cockroach that fell on me. And he was just like, oh, I'm sorry. I was like, you might want to look into that. Like, just check it out. I generally don't mind bugs. Like, if a spider gets on me, there's an initial startle reflex. But it's something about it being in the hair that I hate. Like emerging from your hair, because you're like...
It wasn't emerging in my hair. And it was a tiny spider. But yeah, the idea of it emerging from your hair feels like a creepy urban legend.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Like the, oh, what's that? The Grudge, you know?
Yes, how, like,
the
exactly.
Thing, the fingers coming out of
the
hair.
I didn't mind the tiny spider. I looked at it. It might have been a fig eater beetle.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Because it was big and iridescent. And that getting caught in my hair, I did mind. That I was like, you are too big. Get out of my hair right now.
Yes. No. I've been smacked by those ones.
Those are annoying. Fly and they just, it's just like, you are so big. How can you fly?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, like, that's how I feel about cicadas, too. They look too meaty to fly, but they are lighter than they look. Yeah. And they have big wings. Even though, like, maybe getting smacked in the face or having them land in your hair might be unpleasant, you don't really have anything to worry about because they are vegetarian vampires. They will not suck on human blood. They only suck on tree blood or sap out of roots and tree twigs. So thankfully, they are not out for human blood. That's good to know.
That is good. If they were, we would all be screwed.
We would, definitely. Oh, we'd be so dead. So the extremely loud calls they make are due to their bodies basically being designed like an instrument. Mm. So males sing to attract females. So that loud droning buzz you hear in the summer that can be ear-splitting at times is males going, come on and get some of this, to all the females trying to attract them.
It's kind of like a rising and falling sound, right? Like, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it kind of sounds like a little tiny buzzsaw that, like, little forest gnomes are doing some serious high rises in the forests with little teeny tiny buzzsaws. But yeah, it gets very loud. I mean, it gets as loud as a buzzsaw. Like, it's very, very loud.
Well, because there are thousands of them, right?
Well, even a single one can produce a very loud call. And then when you combine them, it can be deafening because one cicada can produce a sound that is about almost as loud as a chainsaw.
Wow.
Yeah. So crickets and other loud sound making bugs and other, like, there are lots of animals that can make loud sounds, often use a technique called stridulation to produce their call. That's where they rub their wings or legs over a ribbed body structure and kind of like play themselves like one of those wood scraper instruments.
Yeah.
Remember in school when they made you sit in the circle and you're like, here, you get this wood block that you hit and then you get this like ribbed wood thing that you like scrape back and forth. You get the triangle.
Yeah.
And like they would only entrust the triangle to the non-annoying kids.
Yeah.
Because like otherwise the situation would get out of control.
That was a privilege. Yeah. Yeah.
That was, yes, definitely, because otherwise it was just like clang, 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 and pandemonium. Yeah, like that wooden thing that has like the grooves in it, and you like rub the stick on it, and it makes that like rrr, 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 noise, and it's like kind of the lame instrument that you get, and you don't really love it. But that is how a lot of crickets, and that's how other animals will produce that loud noise, through stridulation. But cicadas don't use this technique. Like, they are actually different. They don't use stridulation. They instead have specialized structures in their exoskeleton called timbals. So timbals are these membranes that are connected to muscles that can vibrate them rapidly, producing a very loud sound. In fact, cicadas are the loudest insect in the world. So it's kind of like, you know, those like big metal sheets that you shake to make it sound like it's thunder.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I've seen that happen. Like I worked on, I remember working on a movie once and we We were on this lot that used to be like an Air Force base, I think. And there was a pool in there, and they made thunder sounds by putting a giant sheet of metal in the pool.
Oh, wow.
And this like really scary echo. Yeah, I was always amazed by that.
That's interesting. I didn't realize they actually put it in, submerged it like in water.
It wasn't in water. It was an empty pool.
Oh, I see. So it would like the resonance of it.
Yeah, the resonance would be very.
That's cool.
It was really cool. I you know, it was one of those like, oh, that's how they do that kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah, that would be, I feel like that would be spooky though. There's something about like big empty rooms and then like loud sounds in them.
It was very spooky. Yeah.
Yeah, it's spooky. It's like the idea of like going to an abandoned theme park and then all of a sudden like the carousel just starts up and it's just music and an empty. And then you're like, uh-oh, well, zombies are going to come now.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. You know, what have you done? Yeah.
But yeah, so these timbales kind of work like those big metal sheets, but they're smaller and they vibrate them much more quickly, and so you get that, I don't know if you'd call it high pitched, but sort of medium pitched like buzzing humming sound.
Yeah,
and I provided you with lovely images of cicadas in like a little animated. Textbook illustration that should, I don't know how helpful this animation is. I'll include it in the show notes so everyone can see it, but basically it's showing like, look, it's this membrane and it like sort of wobbles in and out.
I find it really interesting. Also, I love that it's from a site called cicadamania.com. Everybody has their thing.
I've got a subscription.
Everybody has their thing that they love. Yeah.
I'm actually subscribed to Cicada Biweekly, but yeah, it's it looks, and it's interesting because it's this kind of rib structure. It looks mechanical. It looks like a machine part. In fact, the whole cicada looks very robot-like to
me. They do.
It looks like an alien machine, you know, kind of like a mixture between organic and machine, which I find pretty cool. But yeah, so that's how that sound is produced, and just for fun, I will play a really loud cicada. I'll make sure it doesn't. It's not going to blow out your ears because I'm going to control the volume. So don't worry. But you know that it sounds like construction work. Here is what it sounds like.
To me, it sounds almost like somebody revving up a motorcycle engine.
Yeah.
Because it kind of goes like. There's like sort of a rise and fall.
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah, it's like little forest gnomes on their massive hogs just like revving around.
Trying to get women's attention, which like was probably, probably what a lot of dudes on motorcycles are trying to do.
Yeah, you're right. Cicadas are very much like dudes on motorcycles going.
Yeah, just making some noise. Yeah, that's what it seems like to me.
Yeah, so fellas and ladies out there, if you're trying to seduce someone, just like make really loud buzzing noises. I think it'll work. You've got the creature feature guarantee that'll get you some phone numbers.
Buy a motorcycle. It'll definitely attract some people for sure.
Or a buzzsaw.
Yeah, or a buzzsaw. Well, yeah, if you just stand around with a buzzsaw, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know how many people that'll attract to you, but
very special people.
Yes. Yes.
It'll be a match made in heaven once you find someone who appreciates
depends
the
on where you do
the buzzsaw.
It. Yeah,
right.
Yeah. Yeah.
In a forest, maybe then it's like, oh, you're a lumberjack.
Yeah.
In the middle of it, the street, maybe not.
Yeah, not gonna make friends.
So now we know what cicadas are, and so we are ready to welcome millions and millions of new cicadas into the world this spring. It's like, you know, spring is always associated with cute little bunnies and cute little baby chicks, but why not cute little cicadas? So the spring is very special because the periodical cicadas are having their moment. So there are a few species of cicada that have periodical broods. So a mass brood that stays in stasis underground, often for over a decade, and will emerge all together in one big party. So right now, in eastern and central U.S., cicadas that have been resting and developing underground for 17 years will emerge fully grown and ready to mate. So if you're 17 years old and listening to this podcast, like, these cicadas are the same age as you. They've just been, your entire life have been waiting underground to emerge.
Oh, so maybe I was born in a cicada year.
You could have been, yeah.
Because I think I turned 17 the last time they were around. So yeah, so maybe.
You're a cicada baby.
Exactly.
So this group of emerging periodical cicadas this spring are called Broodex, which I love how menacing. Like, I love how scientists don't shy away from naming things, like, menacingly.
They don't. I mean, of course, you have to.
You lean into it,
yes,
you know?
Yes.
I love the book Lean In by a cicada, and it's just like a cicada on the cover looking professional. So this group of emerging periodical cicadas will emerge around May of this year in Delaware, Illinois, Georgia, Indiana, New York, Kentucky, Maryland, North Carolina, New Jersey, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Tennessee, Virginia, West Virginia, Michigan, Washington, D.C. So if you live in any of those places, congratulations!
Yep.
There will be millions of cicadas coming out this spring, and they will be extremely loud because they are looking for mates. Basically, what happens is they'll pop out of the ground, mate, lay their eggs, and then die in a few weeks. So the males will make their characteristic buzzes, and the females will flick their wings, which makes this kind of like snapping sound, like a finger snap, but much louder. And that is signaling to the male that they are enticed by their revving sounds, and then they go and mate. And then the female will lay the eggs in the branches of trees, and shortly after that, the adult cicadas die, because that's it. Like, that's their, they've had their big party, and then they're like, well, I'm out of here, and then they die. And that's why there's a bunch of, Mari, you were mentioning, you found a bunch of cicada corpses.
Yeah.
Now, you'll also find often, like, a bunch of, they're not necessarily corpses, but the final molting. So it's like they molt out of their various life stages. And so if you find sort of a hollow, sort of kind of like amber colored, like, it looks like sort of a casing.
I remember what they look like because of the game Neko Atsume, the cat collecting game. One of the cats, like, the cats will give you little treats, and it'll be stuff like a broken collar. It's the kind of stuff cats will bring you, like a shoelace or a broken
half
collar.
A mouse.
And yeah, exactly. And one of them is actually a cicada molting.
Oh, wow.
They'll bring you a cicada molting. And I remember I saw that, and I first saw it, it like brought back so many memories. I was like, oh my gosh, I haven't seen one of these in years, but I know exactly what it is.
Yeah. So you need to connect me with this game, because I need to play any game that makes a cicada reference.
Yeah, it's the Neko Atsume. It's the cat collector game for
I love
iPhone.
This.
It's very cute.
I got to check it out.
Yeah.
This episode is not sponsored by this, by the way. So, but if you want to sponsor us, get at me. So you'll find both the cicada corpses, which you can tell if they're the corpses, because they have the full wings, and I think the ones in the U.S. are sort of blackish blue color, and then their wings are lined in a bright orange, and so that's the adult form of the cicada, whereas the casings, like the molted cicadas, is sort of, it'll be this like kind of translucent amber color, and the wings are clearly not fully developed on these, because in their earlier stages of formation, the wings are little and they're not functional yet, because they get bigger and bigger with each molting. So
they don't travel in groups, but they like live in groups, right? Like
yes.
In swarms. Yeah.
Because
I remember hearing them all together.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, like, this is sort of the entire point of this mass emergence from the ground, is that they emerge all at the same time, basically, millions of them, and then all mate at the same time, lay their eggs at the same time, and then that'll start the process again. So
yeah, I was because I bet like females probably aren't that discriminating when it comes to, yeah.
They can actually be because they have the luxury to be discriminating because there's so many males.
Right.
So like they'll listen to these calls, and if they like the song, like if it's like, yeah, that's a nice motor revving sound. Mm-hmm. They'll invite the male over with the wing flicks, and then they'll mate. So
I just feel like if you do your wing flick at like a group of guys, who's going to know? How do they know who it is? No, not you. That guy. No, that one. No, that one over there. No, not you. Yeah.
That's a really good question. I'm not sure. I would imagine it may have something to do with timing. Like they hear a call and then they sort of do a wing flick at them right after their call. But yeah, you're right. Like there must be some. That's a really good question. I wonder if there's any research on like how they are able to like directionally locate where the stuff is coming from. I'm sure they probably have a very interesting auditory system.
Yeah.
Their auditory system actually also works as a resonance chamber. So it's like they have this very complex little machine apparatus. So I wouldn't be surprised if they have some very complex way of being able to differentiate the direction of sound so that would make it easier to
make.
That's a really good question.
I went to theater school. I'm very familiar with resonators, with using your vocal resonators. And so yes.
My what now? What'd you call me?
Just using the different parts. Yeah, that's so resonance is something that, you know, I admire in other creatures.
They're natural born actors. Especially...
They live and die on the stage. Yeah.
And also with like how many of them are trying to
exactly. Yeah, it's true. Oof. It's true.
When the female lays the eggs, they'll actually lay them in the branches of trees. And then again, the adult cicada is like, well, we had our big party. Now we're out. See ya. And they die. And then when the eggs hatch with this little teeny nymph, like a baby cicada, the nymphs will fall to the ground and burrow down a couple feet near the tree roots, near the plant roots. And then they will wait another 17 years before they emerge again. Underground, they live off the juices of the tree roots, which is called xylem. Basically, like I said, they are tree vampires, and they take years to fully mature. So they go through many stages of molting and transformations from the nymph form, which is the young wingless stage after hatching, to adults, where they have the full wings and they're ready to party. So they slowly develop those wings with each molting. And then once they reach their final stage of maturation, which is about at the same time, because again, they were all, the eggs were laid at the same time. They all went underground at the same time. They're all synchronized, which is incredible.
Yeah.
They will start to burrow upwards and they test the temperature of the earth. And once it is above about 64 degrees Fahrenheit or 18 degrees Celsius, they're like, yep, temperature's right. Out we come. And then it happens again. And they actually leave a bunch of holes in the ground, which for me, that's like the spookiest part. It's not seeing all the cicadas. It's like seeing the holes. Like, have you ever read a Junji Ito, like his horror comics?
No, I don't think I have. But that does sound creepy.
There's a horror manga where it's like all these human shaped holes in a cliff face and like people go inside and just get sucked up. It's just like all these like little cicada holes. It's a little creepy. I don't know why, but that's the part that kind of creeps me out. And it's not trypophobia. I don't have that. That's the
fear of holes. Yeah.
It's not really that. I think it's just the knowing what they are. Like that's where like this brood comes out from. I don't know. Gives me the shivers.
I feel like if you grew up in Southern California or, you know, anywhere in the Southwest, you probably, holes in the ground mean snakes.
Right.
So I always, you know, my dad would always say, never put your hand or foot somewhere you can't see.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's a good point. Yeah. Cause like, I remember when I was a little kid and I was like digging around in the dirt and I found a hole. I was like, oh, I'll dig down in this hole. And scorpion in there. Don't do that.
Yeah. Don't do that. That's, I have, I have family that live in the desert, and they're just kind of like, well, the cat killed another scorpion today.
Yeah.
And scorpions are so common to them. And I'm like, that's a bit overwhelming for me. Scorpions are, I think they're fascinating and cool, but I wouldn't want them to be doing battle with my cats or me.
Yeah, they're great parents, scorpions are, but I don't want them in my room. I'm in my parents' house where I grew up, where actually I am right now because I'm visiting my parents because the vaccine, hooray.
Yeah.
We're right next to sort of this arid canyon area. And so for whatever reason, the bugs loved my room. Maybe they could sense a kindred spirit, but I would get scorpions would get in there, and it's like it would only be my room for some reason. Or maybe I was the only one looking around for scorpions, but I get scorpions. I got like a planarian once. It's like weird, sort of worm thing. And I got the, you mentioned, I think it was a misnomer. You were talking about the fig beetles, but but Jerusalem crickets are around here as well. So I got one of those.
Those are very creepy. My room.
Yeah. Those are creepy. Their faces, something about them. I don't know. But yeah, so I got a bunch of weird bugs, including scorpions. Never a cicada, though. Only heard them from a distance. Speaking of bugs and them encroaching on us, you may be asking, why do they do this mass brooding event? Is it just to scare us? Is it an intimidation thing? Oh God, why are they doing this? So it's interesting because most cicada species aren't like this. They don't lay in wait for 17 years and then emerge en masse. Like they live for a few years and they have like annual mating cycles, just typical stuff. The periodical brooding cicadas are interestingly different. Like their whole name is based on this brooding habit. They're called Magicicada, which sounds like it's like magic cicada, which is I love. But it actually comes from the Latin magi or magi. I think it's magi.
Magi,
which means to a great extent. So it's basically saying like there's a bunch of them. But I also like to think that it's because they're magic, just like magic cicada.
Yeah.
But the purpose of this huge brood emergence is probably safety in numbers.
Right.
There are so many of them. As an individual cicada, you're statistically unlikely to be preyed upon in such a huge mass of others. And it makes mating easier because you just have one big meet and greet party with millions of sexy singles in your area.
Exactly. It's what everybody like, you know. What people be like, you know, me and my homies once we get the vaccine, you know.
Yes.
Of course, it's not going to be like that. It's much more going to be like, you know, us slowly, you know, climbing out of our cave where we've been hibernating. Yes, it's probably not going to be as fun and sexy as the cicadas.
I mean, you know what? I didn't make that connection until now, but you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
This is like a metaphor for emerging from quarantine.
Yeah, yeah.
We're coming out of our holes that we've been in for, which feels like 17 years, but it's been over a year. And then we'll probably have a mass mating event. And we should definitely call, like, all the babies that happens because of, like, after the quarantine and everyone, like, mating, we should call them brood X.
They should be brood X. Yes, that would be a great, and yeah, that would be a great name for them, I think, the brood X babies.
And they would share, oh my God, this is so perfect. It's like when nature is just poetic because they're going to share a birthday with millions of cicadas.
Yeah.
So we'll have a bunch of cicada babies who are born at, like, well, I guess not exactly because they'll be conceived now. There's going to be a 9-month delay.
Quarantine's been long enough that there are, you know, conceived in quarantine babies.
That's true. I thought there wasn't, like, there was expected a baby boom, but there wasn't because people didn't feel like having a child. Who would have thunk?
There might still be right. In the next, but probably it was a bit too depressing.
I think the celebratory we're out of quarantine baby boom is going to be much bigger. I mean, also because I think probably a lot of people wanted to have children and then were waiting until after quarantine to have children. So like I imagine a lot of them are going to be planned pregnancies of like, hey, we're out of quarantine, now we can start our families.
So, yeah, exactly.
And so they're going to be, it's beautiful. Your babies are going to share a special year with the millions of cicadas that are also going to breed this year.
Yeah, cicada generation.
Ah, wonderful. It's beautiful. It's like a poem.
It's sort of they're synchronized, you know, much like the cicadas themselves.
Now we're synchronized with the cicadas. Yes. So we're just going to slowly become more and more cicada-like.
They got a good thing going.
Yeah. Another proposed theory for why they have such a long brooding cycle is that it makes it hard for predators to adapt to your weird intervals. So like if you are only, like you only emerge every 17 years, evolutionarily, it's kind of difficult for predators to have, like they don't have, a lot of predators don't have a lifespan of 17 years. So matching up with that and being able to develop specific evolutionary traits to be able to prey upon you is harder. Although some biologists disagree with this theory, they say like, well, there's actually a fungus that has developed that can specifically prey upon these periodical cicadas. So obviously there's, you know, but I still think that like, yeah, obviously fungus, like probably because it's under the ground.
And fungi are terrifying.
They are. Yeah. There's no defeating fungi. Like, that's the final boss, honestly. Yeah. Like, we're like, oh, no, cicadas. No, cicadas, we don't have to worry about them. Fungi, that's what we got to worry about.
Yeah.
That's what the zombie virus is not going to be a virus. It's going to be a fungus.
Yeah. The most,
right in our brains.
Like, the most terrifying, like, I think about how I'll walk outside and I'll see mushrooms pop up out of nowhere one morning.
Yeah.
And then the next day, they'll be gone. And I'm like, yeah. How did you do that? How did you pop up and then go away? I do not understand them. I have respect for them.
Yeah, I'm not a fungi expert as much as I wish I was. But yeah, there's something about them that spooks me because they're not an animal, but they're not really a plant either.
Yeah,
they're in that in between zone of spookiness. And yeah, so especially the parasitic fungus like cordyceps. Ugh.
Yeah.
Spooky, because that goes inside an ant's brain or other insects.
Oh,
makes
right.
them go like takes over their brain, makes them climb up a tree branch and then sprouts spores like right out of their brain. That's what the Last of Us that the video game about zombie apocalypse, like that The Last of Us based their zombie infection on the cordyceps.
Oh, really? Oh, that makes sense. Yeah, I've heard about The Last of Us, but nobody has told me that. That sounds really cool.
Yeah, it is. I really loved that aspect of the game. It's like the biological meshing sort of these biological facts with the science fiction scenario.
I mean, we kind of understand bacteria. We kind of understand viruses, but yeah, like fungi and like, what are they? Prions, those things are.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Those things are.
Oof. Those are the misfolded proteins that just like, causes a ruckus in your brain.
Those
don't
are
like
scary.
That.
Those are very scary.
Yeah, those are scary. But I do think like, aside from fungi, which are not a fun guy, get it? You know, I think that strategy of like, if you lay in wait for like 17 years, like birds aren't going to know what to do about you. Like their lifespans are typically not 17 years long. So they're not going to have any memory of these brooding events. They're not going to know like when to come and prey on you. So I think that maybe that is part of the strategy. Interestingly, sometimes there are stragglers who either come too early or too late to the big brooding party. So it's not perfect, you know. Nobody's perfect. Pobody's nerfect. And that applies to cicadas, too.
I feel like I've heard them before. I've heard like one soul. Yeah. Yeah. I feel like we get that. Like we used to get they're not actually June bugs, but we call them June bugs in California. And like once or twice we would get a June bug. That was late. My mom was like, oh, sorry, dude. You're late. It's not June anymore. And cicadas, sometimes you'd hear like one and it was just like, oh, that's so sad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's like, anybody is still out here?
Yeah.
But what's interesting is if there's enough stragglers, because there's so many of them, even if you're a straggler, the chance that there's going to be another straggler is pretty high. So sometimes there are enough of them that they actually successfully mate, like a group of them, and then they can get off sync a little bit from the rest of them, and that can actually start a new brood. That also, they still have like the 17-year cycle, but because they're like off sync just a little bit, they start like a different brood that will actually hatch a different year. So there are many different cicada broods. So brood X is not the only one. There are cicada broods that emerge every 17 years. There are some that also emerge every 13 years, so slightly different species.
Yeah, because I know I've heard cicadas at times that weren't just, yes. that wasn't just 17 years ago.
Yes, because there, well, first of all, there's the cicadas that aren't periodical brooders. So they are around every year, and they don't do this behavior of waiting 17 years. They have like a yearly reproductive cycle. Mm-hmm. But you may be saying like, well, I've seen like mass emergence of cicadas and it hasn't been 17 years since I've seen it. And that's because like they're on these different cycles. So this is not, it's not that this event only happens every 17 years. This brood X is only going to happen every 17 years because their population is on this schedule. But there are going to be other staggered populations of cicadas that are on different schedules.
Yeah.
So we see these mass brood emergence events every few years. And so it's, so if you're like, uh-oh, I'm going to miss this mass brood emergence, don't panic. There will be another one. And then you won't have to wait 17 years. But if you want to see this specific brood event, you will have to wait another 17 years. there's enough cicadas for everyone. Don't worry. Speaking of which, actually, apparently I read that cicadas taste like canned asparagus.
Really?
Which I don't know what like the like Venn diagram of like people who have eaten canned asparagus and people who have eaten cicadas. Who has both eaten canned asparagus, yuck, and cicadas? Like enough people have eaten both of them that they're like, oh yeah, this is like the canned asparagus that I eat. Like what?
Yeah, I mean, liking asparagus is like a very specific thing anyway. Like I think asparagus is okay. It's not my favorite. My sister loves it and she cooks it a lot. And you know, sometimes I'll eat it if she cooks it, but I've never had it canned and that sounds really gross.
No, I'm like you. Like, I'll have, like, roasted asparagus. I don't love it. It's a little too fibrous for me.
Yeah.
Also making your pee smell weird. I'm not into that. I couldn't, like, eat it. Something about canned asparagus just does not appeal to me at all. But then it's like, who's eat, like, I, well, actually, you know what? I guess it makes sense. The kind of person who would regularly eat canned asparagus probably would eat a cicada just out of curiosity.
They're already eating weird stuff, so yeah,
right,
why not?
Right. Yeah, it's like, what? Look, once you've stooped to the level of eating canned asparagus, why not just try a cicada?
I'm thinking, is it like army rations or something? Or like survivalists? Because survivalists. Because that seems like the kind of people who would do it. They'll be like, yeah, we eat bugs. We've also eaten, you know, these canned vegetables. Yeah, of course.
Look, bugs are going to be the meat of the future.
Yeah. Which, I mean, like, yes, it grosses me out to think about. Like, I both am like, oh, this is actually like a really good idea to like make cricket flour or something like that.
Right.
Because it's more readily available and it's, you know, probably safer and maybe even then probably more humane than like factory farming and such. But also like the idea also, grosses
gross.
Me out.
No, I'm with you. Like, I'm like, yeah, no, we should be probably eating more insects that would be more.
Yeah.
Ecologically good for the planet. But yuck, gross, icky, no.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it's entirely cultural. I don't think there's any real logic to it. There are places where people do eat insects and like it's totally normal and fine and they'd probably they'd probably look at our food, like they'd probably look at like a Carl's Jr. like burger and be like, what the hell? Like,
yeah, exactly. Gross. No, it totally is cultural. And I feel like there's, and people, you can like survive pretty well off of, off of bugs.
There was a guy that accidentally got stranded, I think somewhere in Australia, like in desert brush area. And he survived by eating witchetty grubs, which are these big, like sort of, you know how in The Lion King there's a scene where they like teach Simba to eat big grubs? They're huge grubs and they just look not super appealing to eat. But people have been for centuries, people have been eating the witchetty grubs as a part of like their diet, and they're perfectly good to eat. And this guy survived by eating them. And yeah, I just, it's totally cultural that we've been brainwashed to reject insects as food.
Yeah.
But somehow be okay with factory farming, which is a little messed up.
Yeah. Which is even grosser. Probably.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. It's way grosser.
I think I don't like eating, I eat meat sometimes. I don't eat a lot of meat, but when I do, I don't think I would like to eat a cricket if it looked like a cricket.
Yeah.
But I also don't like to eat meat that looks like the animal that it is. Like, I feel like, yeah. And I feel like for me, that's a psychological thing, you know?
I'm kind of the opposite. I almost like want to know I'm just eating a bug. Like,
yeah.
I feel like if you're like, this cookie was made out of ground up crickets, I'd be like,
that's true.
Like, here, I've roasted this cricket and it's like prepared it. And you know, I'm like, okay, at least this is being honest with me what it is.
That's true. I wouldn't want to be tricked into eating it or anything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think I would rather eat a prepared bug than I would to eat canned asparagus. Like, absolutely. I'm not eating canned asparagus.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
Like canned. No. Mm-mm. Or canned mushrooms too.
No. Yeah. Those are really gross.
I'd rather eat a freshly prepared insect.
Yeah.
In terms of the cicada brood X, like, should we be concerned about this? Like, are you in imminent danger of having your face covered in cicadas and them, like, you know, skeletonizing you? No. Cicadas are harmless to humans. They don't sting or bite. They are loud. So if you live near where this is happening, you might have some tough nights. But, you know, they're not, they don't hurt humans. They also don't hurt they don't really hurt the trees or crops or anything. They're not like locusts. They don't destroy crops. They will suck the juice out of tree twigs, which also doesn't really hurt the trees that much. Like, it seems actually to just kind of like prune the trees. They don't really do lasting damage to the trees. There are even some arguments with that because they burst out of these holes, it helps aerate the soil and is actually good for the trees.
Huh.
I feel like it's probably a net neutral because they do suck some of the juices out of the roots. And when they lay their eggs, they actually like kind of cut into the tree a little bit to like stuff the eggs in so they're secure there. So I think it's probably just a neutral effect on the trees. But I have seen some arguments that it's actually beneficial. So maybe, but either way, they're not harmful. So just enjoy the big cicada party that happens only once every 17 years.
They're kind of the musical theater kids of the insect world, which, I mean, I relate to as a musical theater kid. They're really annoying, but they're harmless.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. don't hate on them too much. Just let them do their thing, you know, you know, you can find them annoying, but they're just, you know.
Yeah. They might be cosplaying as vampires, but it's
exactly.
Really just like tomato juice. So, you know.
They just want to hook up at the cast party. You know, they just want to hook up at the cast party. So let them have their party full of, you know, massage trains and
you know. And then they'll go back underground soon enough.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. they'll grow out of it, you know, just as theater kids. Yeah. Kind of grow out of there. Yeah, that's what they are. Cicadas are the theater kids.
Yeah, I'm sure theater kids are going to be okay with that comparison.
Yeah, yeah. I'm okay with it, and I'm a theater kid, so yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You're the president of theater kids.
Oh, God. Am I? I might be.
So we've talked about cicadas and their mass brooding events, but they are not the only animal that does this. Mar, are you familiar with sea turtle mass hatching events?
No, I'm not, but please tell me because I love turtles.
Yes, so thousands of female sea turtles have this uncanny ability to emerge from the ocean all at once to lay their eggs at specific beaches. So there are all of Ridley sea turtles are one such species who will emerge by the thousands to lay their eggs at select beaches. Like there's a beach called Ostional in Costa Rica, and they seem to specifically select particular beaches to all come and lay their eggs en masse. And because they're all coming at the same time to lay their eggs, that means the eggs will all hatch around the same time as well.
Wow.
And so when these eggs hatch, they'll come out because, like, they bury them in the sand and they have each one has a clutch of, I think, a couple dozen eggs. And then they'll all come out at the same time. And the hatchlings will instinctively go towards the ocean, possibly guided by light reflecting off of the water. Some of them, like, they'll come out during night, and like the moonlight reflecting off the water seems to be a beacon for them. These turtles, even though there are so many of them, actually surprisingly few will reach adulthood because they're small and delicious, like little cinnamon buns.
Yeah.
And so, like, there are lots of scavengers and predators who wait for these events. They know it's happening. And these are very tasty treats for them because they're so defenseless, and they can't move that quickly. So when they emerge, they have this very dangerous trek to the ocean. And so having this mass hatching event, again, gives you safety in numbers. Like, you right. are, you know, you may not make it to the ocean, but like you're much have a much better chance if you're one of like thousands and thousands of individuals than if it's just you coming out and then like a seagull's going to immediately see you and just snatch you up. So yeah, these mass turtle hatchings, they happen all over the world, but like often these populations of sea turtles prefer specific beaches. So there are often these events that people wait for these turtles to hatch and watch them, or like sometimes
I would love to do that. I love turtles. Yeah.
It's quite something. I mean, the babies are so cute. It's hard though, because like, you know, a lot of them aren't going to make it. So, yeah. And you shouldn't interfere. Sometimes there are rescue groups that will like, kind of try to help, protect them from like poaching and stuff. So, but yeah, I mean, it is quite something though. So, you know, watching a video of just like thousands of these turtles, just like kind of like ambling like with it, because they can't move very well. They just kind of like use their little flippers to like kind of push themselves forward. And it's just like,
I like the little patterns that they leave in the ground.
Yeah.
I'm looking at the little patterns they leave, and it does look like they're just moving forward very, very slowly, just inching. It's very cute.
I mean, they're hustling. You can tell they're hustling as fast as they can. Unfortunately, that's just not very fast.
Yeah.
But yeah, they really try to gun it to the ocean, but they can only move so fast because they're these little tiny like sand dollar sized things, and you're right, the patterns they leave behind are quite beautiful. But you may have heard of these sea turtle mass hatchings, but there are also mass river turtle hatchings
that I didn't know about
in the Amazon rainforest. So in Brazil, on the Purus River in the Amazon rainforest, tens of thousands of baby Araú turtles, also known as the giant South American river turtles, will hatch and make their way to the river. So similar to the sea turtles, they are buried in the sand, which keeps the eggs safe, right? So if you're wondering, well, why don't they just lay them in the ocean or in the river?
Yeah.
The eggs are going to be just sitting ducks or sitting eggs for anything to eat. So burying them in the sand keeps them safe. And so once they hatch, that is when the real trouble starts. So
they say giant. How giant are they?
Yeah. So as adults, the babies are small, obviously, cute little babies. But as adults, they get up to about 200 pounds or 90 kilograms in weight. Those are the larger. I think on average, they don't reach that weight. But like, those are some of the larger individuals. And their shells can grow to be over 3 feet long or over 1 meter long. So I think typically they're a little smaller, so more around like 100 to 150 pounds and a little smaller shells. But they can get quite big. They're also, I think, as adults, very cute. They have these long necks and they have these little piggy noses, little piggy snouts. And then they also often, like, algae will grow on their shells. So I think they're really cool. Sometimes they get, like, these mohawks of algae growing on them. They're really interesting looking, very cool. And then the babies are adorable, but they face a very unfortunate odds. So in a protected area of the Purus River, these turtles will hatch en masse. So in 2020... 90,000 baby turtles hatched just within a few days of each other. And if you think that's going to look like a huge pile of baby turtles, that is what it looks like.
Wow. So, yeah.
Unfortunately, even though there's just so many of them, you'd think like, well, God, there must be like huge numbers of these turtles. Unfortunately, only about 1% of them will reach adulthood.
Yeah.
So it truly is just a law of large numbers. Like, you want to make as many babies as you can because their odds are so slim. And you just want to make sure that some of them will make it to adulthood.
What are their predators? Do you know? I mean, there's probably a lot of different things.
Yeah, for the sea turtles, there are a lot of, like, birds are a big one, but there are also plenty of small sharks, like, in the ocean that are really good predators.
What about the river ones?
And the river ones, again, I mean, there are a lot of scavenging birds, that freshwater birds that will prey for them. And then I'm pretty sure, I mean, there are a lot of big fish in these rivers that would be happy enough to eat them. There's also otters, river otters, I believe, that live in the area.
Oh, yeah. River otters are scary. Like, I like otters, but river otters are scary. They're serious.
They're serious. Like, you think of the cute little sea otters? No.
Yeah.
River otters are huge. They're, like, almost as tall, like, as an adult man.
Yeah.
And they're long. They have huge teeth. They can take on crocodiles. They can, like, literally take on gators and crocodiles and hold their own. So they're serious business. But, yeah, so that is perhaps one of the cutest mass spawnings. But in terms of the biggest mass spawning, you have to go to the Great Barrier Reef.
So
the Great Barrier Reef is home to the largest mass spawning events in the world of coral. So I know coral looks like a plant or a rock, but they are living animals, which is mind-blowing. They don't look like they should be alive. They look like they look like set dressing.
Yeah, my grandmother had a coral ring. And it's weird to me now because I'm like, that's almost like, that's like closer to fur than it is to, like, you know, diamonds.
It's like a skeleton.
Gems. Yeah, exactly. And it was a very pretty ring. But I think about it now and I'm like, oh, so weird that was alive once.
Yes, yes. And so coral are very much alive. They are cnidarians, which is the same phylum as jellyfish and sea anemones. So, yeah, they're actually related to jellyfish and sea anemones. They are often colonial, so that means they form these huge groups of many individual polyps. So a polyp is, like, just, like, one individual. Like, if you see a big branching thing of coral, chances are there are, like, thousands of individual polyps or hundreds of individual polyps, like, on this piece of coral.
Yeah.
So a polyp, generally speaking, for coral is like a sort of oval structure. For some coral, they look more like sort of a long flower with a stem. Some of them are more squat. Some of them look sort of like a flower bulb. Some of them look more like pine cone shaped. But it's a living animal with, like, living tissue, and it eats. They'll filter feed, and they like will come out of this these corals and, like, use their flowering organs to, like, catch prey and filter feed and just whatever is floating around. So colonial polyps will often share sort of a base, either formed by fibrous proteins or calcified materials. And so that will form these big, beautiful structures that you see in the barrier reef. There are two main types of coral. There are soft corals and stony corals. Soft coral, you may not even realize they're coral because they look, they don't look hard. They are visibly soft. They look sort of like a bunch of sea anemones or flowers.
Is that this? Oh, yeah. You have a picture of yellow ones. And they look like they look like those bottle brush tree trees. You know, kind of things. Yeah, they look like spiny, but they look soft.
Yes, yes. They are softer. They don't generally have that, like, hard calcified skeletal structure. They're held together by jelly-like tissues, but they also do have some spiny structures that will support them.
I was going to say, do they feel soft to touch?
So part of them would feel soft to touch, but the part of them that is the sort of, like, base that's holding them together is going to be a little more firm, sort of like spiny, like tree branches.
Right.
But yeah, like the definitely the polyps themselves is going to be softer, but hard coral is going to feel hard. So the stony coral is the stuff that you probably think of when you think of coral. They look like mineral, more like a mineral than an animal, but they are alive. So there are a bunch of tiny polyps on stony coral skeletal structures. And like these polyps are, they're less sort of like flowery looking than soft corals. They're more, a little more conical shaped, and they give like these stony corals a sort of harder, more rocky appearance.
Right.
And because often like these polyps are very tiny, only like 1 to 3 millimeters, you can barely see each individual. It just looks like this rocky texture on like this coral. It doesn't look like there's a bunch of individuals, but if you zoom in, those little bumps are actually like living polyps. And if you ever, I have a visual aid for Mara here. You guys can check out the show notes and see pictures of this. But I actually found, because I, like I mentioned, I'm actually at my parents' house right now, and I found this in the bathroom as a decoration. It's actually a coral skeleton. So this is this is a stony coral, and this is the calcified hard base of the skeleton that would home a bunch of little polyps. And I'm going to hold it up.
Oh, yeah.
So you can see each of these little, like, they look like little holes or little divots. I don't know how much detail you can get from the camera.
Yeah, it looks like little stars on it.
Yes.
Like, they're not holes. They're like little stars.
Right, because that was home to each of these polyps that had this, like, radial sort of branching structure. So each of those little, like feathery kind of star structures is where that little polyp would have grown and have that like radial symmetry, like a sea anemone or like a jellyfish. But it was like a little individual. And of course, all that's left now is the hard calcified structure or the skeleton. So if you have decorative coral, that is a skeleton that you have basically.
Yeah, I think we used to have, as soon as I saw that, I was like, that looks familiar. And I feel like we might've had that in my bathroom when we were little
it's a common bathroom decoration.
Yeah, or like on in like a little display on top of the back when we had like you had like the TV cabinet.
Yeah,
I feel like we had potpourri on one part of it, and we had like pretty rocks and coral on there too.
Yeah,
or maybe like my grandparents had it. Yeah, I feel like that was a very kind of 70s 80s decoration.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, and so it was kind of neat because I was like thinking about this episode and I was just like, you know, doing my business in the bathroom. We don't need to go in detail there. But I saw this like on a shelf and it's like, oh, hey, yeah, that's what I'm talking about today.
Yeah.
Yeah. So because corals are often huge colonies with hundreds of thousands of individual polyps, and the Great Barrier Reef is one of the world's largest coral systems with over 600 distinct coral species, there are millions and millions of individual polyps in the Great Barrier Reef, by my rough calculation. When it is a coral species time to spawn, it gets buck wild in the ocean. So coral are sessile, which is just a way of saying they're immobile. They spend their whole time just kind of staying still. You know, just like we've been on quarantine, we've been sessile on our couches. And so having sex is a problem because how do you have sex and reproduce when you can't really move? So they will release sperm and egg packets into the water. And if these sperm and egg packets just happen to bonk into each other, they will fertilize and form an embryo. So in order to maximize the chance of successful fertilization, they have to synchronize. Because like if you just like send out your egg or your sperm packet and then it's like nobody else is doing it, maybe one person like way far away is doing it, the chance they're going to bonk into each other is like pretty minimal. If everyone's doing it, it's a blizzard of sperm and egg packets, and the chance that you're going to bonk into something and get it fertilized is very high. And so that's what they do. It's this blizzard of coral sperm and eggs, and it's super colorful. So like coral, so as we know, are very pretty, very colorful. And so you wouldn't even guess that it's such dirty business going on here, because it comes in these colors of like yellows and pinks. And it's like this flurry. It looks like a magical enchanted blizzard. But, you know, that's it's coral sex junk happening.
Yeah, there's a photo that I'm looking at here where there's like coral spawning, and it looks like it's like really beautiful. You could put it up as like a photograph, like in your home as like decoration. And then there's another one, and there's a diver in the middle of it. And He looks a little like, okay, what did I get in the middle of here?
Whoops. Oh, you guys. Oh, yeah. Gross.
Guys, just come on.
Yeah. It's like a snow globe. Like you turn in the snow globe and you see all these like big sort of like things of snow, except like it's pink and yellow and it's, you know, coral sex goo.
Yeah.
Once they fertilize, those will create new coral polyps. You can actually look, like there's an aerial photo too, like that shows these like mass coral embryos that creates like this pink film on the ocean. It looks like someone just like spilled a bunch of pink ink in the ocean. It's beautiful. It's just, but it also like shows you the scale of this event. It's just huge, a huge number of horny coral just making babies.
And how often does this happen?
I think this is a yearly event. I'm not sure if like every species does it every year, but they it's staggered enough that this happens relatively often. So should we be worried about this? Not really. I mean, unless you are a fish in a lagoon during an unfortunately timed weather storm that causes coral sex goop to rain down in your home and literally suffocate you, which actually happened wow. 9 years ago in a lagoon in an atoll in the Cocos Island in the Indian Ocean. A fluke storm blew a bunch of coral spawn into a lagoon system, which consumed oxygen, and then the decaying coral polyps released methane, which made the water unbreathable by the fish, who suffocated and died en masse. So sometimes, hey, coral sex does kill.
Wow. Yeah, it's that's like getting caught up in like somebody else's drama.
Oh, geez.
Yeah.
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 Someone like shows you a text like between them and someone they're seeing, and it's like they expect you to resolve the drama. And it's like, no.
Yeah.
No, I'm not going to be a fish in your coral sex lagoon, all right?
That's a great way to tell them no. I'm not a fish in your coral sex lagoon, okay?
They'll know what you mean.
Yeah, they'll know. They should. If they don't, you don't want to be their friend anyway.
Right, exactly. I mean, like, if they're making you be a fish in their coral sex lagoon, I'd say get out of there. Cut those toxic ties.
Yeah.
Well, I think we've covered probably as many mass spawning events as I can tolerate in one episode. But yeah, it's the beautiful cycle of life, which sometimes happens in by the millions. But before we go, I do want to do a listener email that was in response to last week's episode, which is about bunnies. Mara, you missed the bunnies
episode. I missed the bunnies.
By one week. So instead, you had the mass cicada sex episode.
I mean, it's still interesting to me. And I got turtles, which I like. So
that's true.
So that's cute, too.
Massive baby turtles.
Yes.
A lot of them are going to die. But hey, it's cute while they last.
But they're cute while they last. Yeah. It's an ephemeral thing.
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
Yeah.
Enjoy the turtles every moment. Don't think about the turtles of the future. Think about the baby turtles of the now.
Yeah. It's like those, you know, what are those? Like the mandalas that they'll make in sand. You know? Think about the beautiful patterns that the turtles make in sand and enjoy their presence. Yeah.
And then get eaten by a shark.
And yeah. Yeah. That's, you know, so it goes. Yeah.
Well, here is this very nice, not deadly email. Hi, Katie. I'm a longtime listener, and I really enjoyed your Lagomorph episode. I am a bunny owner and an ecologist and really appreciated the love you give to these underappreciated fluff balls. I just wanted to tell you a few cool things that I've learned about pet domestic rabbits. First, they can be letterbox trained fairly easily and successfully, especially if they're spayed or neutered. I think in the show I threw a little bit of shade at bunnies. I said that you can try to litter box train them, but I think it's sort of on whether they feel like it or not.
Yeah.
But apparently I mea culpa, apparently bunnies will fairly readily poop in a litter box.
That's good to know. Although, they seem very stubborn. Every domestic bunny I've met has been like, I have a mind of my, like people think cats are hard to control, bunnies.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, but yeah. But it's a whole new, like, cats are sort of like a little bit, but they're coy and playful about it, where they're like, ooh, maybe will I, won't I? But they do.
Yeah.
They do love you. But like bunnies, they're like, no. Yeah. You think you're going to get me to do something? Uh-uh.
Yep.
I'll kick you in the face and pee on you.
Yes, I've exactly.
That happened to me.
Exactly. Yeah.
although the listener does admit that there will be an occasional misplaced bunny poop. So, hey.
Yeah.
She writes that the secret is to put hay in or next to the litter box so they can eat while they poop or pee.
Whoa.
Luxury. Luxurious living. Once litter trained, the bunnies can roam in an area of the house freely after some bunny proofing. The House Rabbit Society has lots of information on how to do this. I also just wanted to mention a few other super cute bunny behaviors. When they are very excited, bunnies will do a jump and a shake their bodies midair, which is called a binky. And when they are very relaxed, they will dramatically flop over on their side.
Wow. That's so cute.
I actually had a cat named Binky, and he was pretty rabbit-like because he was very scared. He never killed anything and would run away. And one time, this was in high school, and I came home and I was, you know, frustrated with school, so I just dropped my books on the floor, and across the room, I didn't realize the cat was there, and so he jumped like 3 meters into the air. It was so funny. Poor thing. And then the listener shared some beautiful pictures of the bunnies, which are just for me, so... Sorry about that. But, and then she writes, I also especially appreciated your bee episode. I did my master's degree studying native bees in Ontario, so I appreciate it when bee species other than honeybees get a mention. And this is from Emma. Thank you so much, Emma, for your kind words and for your bunny facts. So I take it back. Bunnies can be litter box trained. But again, hey, look, when they want to. There may be a poop once in a while, and you're just going to have to deal with it, right?
Don't pretend like you can control the bunnies.
No, you can't control a bunny.
You can't control the bunnies.
Are you kidding me? No. They are the strong back legs, they can slap you.
Yeah. I have a friend who has bunnies, and she says that they when they're pissed off at you, they'll turn their back on you and kick with their back legs. They'll kick dust at you. Yeah.
Yeah,
which yeah. I love you is I love that about them. It's just like I love you bunnies for being like the hey screw you with their back legs.
Yeah, I mean I like that they stand up for themselves because like we have this sense of like oh they're just little floppy bunnies they don't they're helpless
frightened rabbits yeah.
Yeah, no. I mean it's more like the Peter Rabbit level of like defiance.
My sister was bitten by a bunny once.
Oof.
Yeah,
ouch.
Yeah.
They got strong teeth.
They do. Yeah. She said she had to get a tetanus shot after.
Oof. Yeah. Because their teeth are so long. Yeah. Oh, wow.
She said the shot hurt more than the bite, but it was still very, very strange.
But I mean, basically, the bunny is responsible for the shot, too.
So exactly.
It's adding insult and injury to injury.
Yeah.
No, bunnies are serious business. Like, I know bunnies are cute. I don't necessarily discourage having bunnies as a pet, but if you want one, definitely look into it because I would say they're one of the harder pet, like they're harder than a cat or a dog.
Yeah,
I would say so. Yeah, just check it out because there's a lot of special care you have to do. I had a friend who had a bunny, and again, like I would pet it, and then when it wanted me to stop, it would kick me and pee on me. It was a male, and I think they like to flick urine, so he would kick me and flick urine on me, and I was like, you know, I think I'll stick with cats and dogs.
Yeah. You can predict. They're more predictable.
Yeah.
They're more predictable.
I only sometimes get kicked by my dog, and that's usually unintentional.
Yeah, my cat will you know, they'll go, or maybe they'll hit me or bite me lightly if I'm annoying them.
Yeah.
I'm like, okay, all right, we'll stop petting you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My dog loves belly rubs, but like once, it's like she's got a very specific, you have to pet her very specifically. And if you stop, like, She looks so sweet and angelic, but then if you pet her wrong, like suddenly the little chihuahua demon face comes into play and it's, oh my God, she's like.
It's really funny.
Satan takes over. Yeah. Well, Mara, thank you so, so much for joining me. It's truly been a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you.
Big fan of you. Big fan of your Twitter and your articles. And so I am, you know. Trying to keep the fangirling to a minimum.
No, I mean, I love your stuff, and I feel like, and I love learning about things that I don't know a lot about. So this is really cool to me. This is really fascinating.
I'm so glad that you could learn about, and I'm sorry about all the coral perversion. All the coral sex.
It's fine. It's fine. I'll give them their space. You know, I'm not going to kink shame them.
I mean, if you're like in a lagoon and they foist their kink upon you in the lagoon, that's a problem.
Yeah, but
I'm
you
sorry,
were also
that is problematic.
You were wandering into their space.
month. Oh, I guess. But that was like that. There's like a freak storm that dispensed all of this coral sex goo on these poor fish. It's like a disaster movie, except a lot of coral eggs and sperm.
Attack of the killer coral.
Attack of the killer coral. Coral babies attack. Sounds like there might be a plane.
Yeah, there is.
Or is it a storm of coral stuff?
We've angered the coral gods.
Yeah, now there's just going to be a cyclone of like coral sperm.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah. Oh, well.
Well, thank you again for coming on. Where can people find you?
Thanks. They can find me at Mara Wilson on Instagram and Twitter. I also have a Cameo. I do videos where I will talk about, you know, anything, my cats or cookie recipes or cicadas, what I know of them. Yeah, and those are really fun to make. I have a newsletter at mara.substack.com called Shan't We Tell the Vicar, because I come up with names for fake British TV shows.
Nice.
In them every time I have an entry.
I don't want to put you on the spot, but can you do one?
I can. There's I'm just here to do the hoovering. there's that one. Beamish and Quigley, Bubble and Squeak.
That's perfect.
Yeah, it's perfect. And sometimes it's kind of hard to tell which ones are real and which ones aren't.
Oh yeah, no, I would believe it if you. It's like I'm just here to do the hoovering. I would totally think it was one, a real one. That's great. And you can find the show on the internet at Creature Feature Pod on Instagram, at Creature Feet Pod on Twitter. That's FEAT, not FEET. That is something very different. You can also send me an email at creaturefeaturepod@gmail.com with all your questions, bunny pictures, coral questions. If you have a problem with cicadas making loud sex noises, just let me know. Send me an email. And I'm Katie Golden. You can find me at Katie Golden on Twitter, where I just post all my Katie thoughts. And as always, I'm also pro-bird rights. Or is pro-bird rights me? Am I birds? We'll find out on Twitter. Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed the show and you leave me a rating and review, I will read it and it'll make my day. I'll be floating on cloud 9 all day long when you leave nice reviews. I really appreciate them. And thanks to the Space Cossacks for their super awesome song, Exolumina. Creature Features a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts like the one you just heard, visit the iHeartRadio app podcast, or hey, guess what? Wherever you listen to your favorite shows, I don't judge. Even if you're listening in like a coral sex lagoon, that's fine. Not here to judge you. I'm just here to provide you with entertainment. See you next Wednesday!